Thank you so much. It's just an incredible honor to be here. And I have to say that I'm a huge football fan, a huge college football fan, and I think I've watched a certain punt return 10 times in the last few days. And for me personally, there's a good news, bad news aspect of that. The good news is I'm coming to a place where you guys are happy. The bad news is I cannot possibly compete with that. So I have nowhere to go but down on the boring scale. But I'm here to talk to you about what has happened to us as a country and what can we do about it. But before I get to that, I want to tell a story from my own time, my own childhood, growing up in a small town in Kentucky. And there was something that was not mentioned in that introduction, and that is that I am a nerd American. I, at one point, could almost speak Elvish, that I was such a Lord of the Rings fan. And to tell you what a good father I am in inculcating this with my children, that my oldest daughter once wrote her diary in Elvish. So as a nerd American, I have a lot of stories. Among them, when I was in high school, I struck up an arrangement with my best friend from high school that when we were going to new sci-fi or superhero movies, if he bought the costume, I'd wear it. So what I meant is, for example, when we went to the premiere of Star Trek V years ago in the 1980s, he bought me a Spock costume with the ears, with the black hair wig and everything. I did have hair at that time, but I needed the black wig. And I would go in full regalia, and then I would make a little money on the side as my friends would do little dares. Like, I dare you to walk out into the middle of the lobby and say, pull out a tricorder, which was an old Polaroid camera that we're using as a tricorder, and say out loud, "No intelligent life form readings, Captain." And they'd give me $5 or something if I did that. And so, but we had the ultimate scheme when one of the earlier iterations of Batman came out, the Michael Keaton Batman, and that was The Dark Knight. And you could rent for the magnificent sum in that time of almost $200, the Dark Knight costume, movie perfect. And so he rented that for me, but he said, if I'm going to spend $200, this has got to be a full evening activity. And so we planned an elaborate prank where we would go to a local miniature golf course. My friends would be playing putt-putt. I would run from the neighborhood, vault over the fence, cape flying, run up, knock one of my friends out of the way, grab the other one, and declare, "Gotham is safe from crime." Now, this is something that only like the 17-year-old male mind can come up with as remotely funny. But so we execute the plan. I'm in the full regalia, and they're playing putt-putt, and I come running. I vault with all of my 17-year-old athleticism over the low fence. I run up, and they both start running away from me, yelling, "Help! An insane man is here!" So they flipped it around on me. "Call the police! A crazy person is on the loose!" I had no idea what to do. I'm standing there in Batman costume. And so I panic, and I start running away from the police that I assume are coming, vault over the fence, run through a neighborhood, and realize I don't know where my car is. And so start running through a random neighborhood in Lexington, Kentucky, cape flying in the wind, completely lost, until my friends circle around, come and pick me up, laughing at me the whole way. It took me about 10, 15 minutes to laugh with them, but eventually I did. So I think the application of this is obvious. This concludes the forum. Appreciate. No, believe it or not, I'm going to circle back to this. Because what is this? What did I just tell you? What I told you was a story of friendship. This is what life with good friends is like. And this is going to be very relevant very soon. Okay, so why would I bring up friendship? Why would I bring up what life with friends is like? And the reason is, is that in the United States of America, if you talk about what we're dealing with, it is a crisis of affection, it is a crisis of regard, and it is an epidemic of outright hatred in the United States. If you were going to talk about why is it that our politics has gone so crazy, why is it that our culture, we always seem to be at odds with each other, why is it that we have things like cancel culture that have arisen, and I can sum it up in one word. I can sum it up in one word. Hatred. Hatred. Americans from different political tribes hate each other in this country. Now, I don't want you to think that this is something brand new. This has been building for a while. So if you go back to the year 2014, so this is 10 years ago, the Pew Research Center had been studying American polarization, and it began to ask Americans, what do you think of people on the other side? If you're a Republican, do you strongly dislike, somewhat dislike, strongly like, somewhat like a Democrat? And if you're a Democrat, what are your feelings towards Republicans? So in 2014, this is 10 years ago, before most of these people in this room were even thinking about politics at all, 10 years ago, the answer was 82% of Republicans either strongly dislike or somewhat dislike Democrats. 82%. Now, Democrats, to their credit, were much more tolerant. Only 79% of them hated or strongly disliked Republicans. And so has it gotten better or worse since 2014? It is substantially worse. It is substantially worse. If you ask a partisan Republican what they think of a Democrat, you're going to get a number in the mid to high 80s% that says they're bigoted, they're intolerant, they're hateful. You name the negative characteristic. And similarly, if you ask Democrats about Republicans, they'll say they're bigoted, they're intolerant, they're hateful. There's even this concept that is now called lethal mass partisanship. Lethal mass partisanship. Now, what could that possibly be? Well, there's about 20% of Americans, believe it or not, who believe that the country would be somewhat better off if a substantial portion of their fellow citizens on the opposing side just died. If they just died, that our country would be better off. Now, they're not wanting to kill them. They just think, well, if mass bus strikes, if people are hit by buses at a max, mass scale, it'd be fine. Now, you might be a sort of a glass half full kind of person, and you say, well, the good news here is 80% of Americans don't actually want their neighbors to die. That is a good news element. But 20% of American adults is around 45, 50 million people. And do you think that the people who hate the other side the most are the least inclined to be involved in politics? No, the people who are burning with hatred right now and burning with this ferocious partisan animosity are among the people the most likely to be involved in politics, most likely. And so you're getting some of the angriest people in America who are disproportionately drawn to politics, and they're energy is being fueled by animosity. Now, it's not everybody. I know it's not everybody. I know you have politicians in the state, people I've known and got to know who I appreciate who are offering alternative visions. So I'm not describing something that is all politicians, but I am describing something that is characteristic of our politics. And so one of the questions is, why? Why do we hate each other so much? And the answer lies in some complicated social phenomenon that are just pulling us apart, just shredding us, pulling us apart. And one of them is called the Big Sort. If you've never heard of this before, this is a super important concept. And what it means is beginning several decades ago, it became apparent that Americans were wanting to move and live around people of like mind. So I come from Tennessee, outside of Nashville, a very, very conservative part of the United States. And a lot of people moved to Tennessee to be around more conservative people, making my neighborhood even more conservative. Then you have other parts of the country that are every bit as liberal as my part of Tennessee is conservative, and people move there. Now, this is completely normal stuff. It's actually very understandable why you would want to do this. It's easier, right, to live around people that share your values. It's nice. You don't have to feel like you're constantly countercultural. But there's a negative effect of this. And it's, if you remember nothing that I say today, like nothing, remember this concept because it explains so much of the United States of America. And it's called the law of group polarization. The law of group polarization. And what this means is that when people of like mind gather, they tend to become more extreme. So in other words, when you gather together with people who agree with you on something, then you tend to, as an entire group, become more extreme than sometimes the most extreme individual was at the start of the meeting. This is something that's just human nature. Think of it like this. If six of you support gun rights, or if six of you are opposed to gun rights, and you get together and it's just you, there's no dissenters, there's no disagreement around the table, you're going to leave that meeting more convicted and more committed to your position. This is just a human thing. But now let's scale that up. It used to be that American politics, you were a kind of in a bell curve where most people were in the middle. Now we're flattening that. The big sword is flattening that to where you have sometimes as many, by some measures, as many people on the extremes as you have in the middle. That has a huge dynamic on our politics. And then here's this other thing that is happening. As we become walled off from each other, with the growth of screens, with the growth, going back before phones to television, we began to disassociate from each other. We began to lose connection. So at the same time we're sorting ideologically, another thing is happening called bowling alone. This is a concept from a guy named Robert Putnam who wrote this book 25 years ago. And he said, we're just not doing anything together anymore. We're not a part of civic associations. We're not part of churches. Church attendance is declining. We don't play in sports leagues. We don't do in bowling leagues. Although as a veteran of the, and I use that word advisedly, of the Nashville, Tennessee Church Softball League, I will tell you that I don't think that's bringing us together. That's trying to reinstitute the wars of religion right there. But we're not part of things that we do together. We're not part of the things that we do together. And that has a consequence. That has a consequence. And that consequence is so much deeper than politics. The malady and the problems in our politics are a symptom of an underlying disease. And what we're beginning to understand that underlying disease is a lack of connection. It's a lack of connection. And so here is what I want to get at today. What is the solution to our crazy hate-filled politics? It isn't one party winning and another party losing. It isn't your favorite politician winning and your most hated politician losing. It is actually replacing alienization and loneliness with connection and love. That is the reason behind the reason for our politics is our lack of connection. So why would I say this? Why would I say this? Recently, AEI, American Enterprise Institute, came out with a study that showed that, think about this, if you're an American and you have a high school diploma or less, 30 years ago, only 3% of you had no close friends. Only 3%. By the year 2023, 1 in 4, almost 1 in 4, 24% of Americans with a high school diploma or less, had no friends at all. No close friends at all. The percentage of working class Americans who went from having multiple friends to went from about 40% down to around 17%. So a higher percentage of working class Americans report having no friends at all than reported having many friends. College educated folks had declines in friendship, but not as dramatic. And what do we know? What do we know what happens to human beings when they lose that connection with each other? 3 distinct things occur. Here's number 1. An individual who is isolated and alone, unless you're an extreme introvert, that is a formula for loneliness, for despair, and for, in many times, a formula for self-destructive behavior. If you're going to look at deaths of despair in the United States of America, the category of person who's overwhelmingly likely to die by suicide, by drug addiction, or alcohol overdose is a single or divorced man. It's a lonely man. That's overwhelmingly likely. So if you're looking, there is a personal despair aspect of it. Then there is also an aspect of it that is radicalizing politically. Believe it or not, loneliness radicalizes people politically. There's a group called Over Zero that did a survey of Americans and asked, where do you feel a sense of belonging and where do you feel a lack of belonging? And especially working class Americans overwhelmingly felt a lack of belonging in their homes, in their communities, and in their workplaces. And what does that mean? It means that they become isolated in their own communities, and we know that isolation breeds anger. Isolation breeds attraction to authoritarian movements. Why is that? Because it gives people a purpose, and it can give them also a community. Here's the other thing that we know. We also know that isolation breeds economic stagnation. Now, this might sound strange, but one of the best things that any person can do in the United States of America to improve another person's social mobility is become friends across social classes. If you have friends across social classes, that is one of the number one indicators of social mobility. So here we have a world that is in pain, where people are separated by ideology, where people hate each other, where friendships are declining. And who is the community? Who is the community that can move in that moment? I don't know if we have any WWE fans in here, but I grew up on it. In the South, we called it wrestling. So there's wrestling and then there's wrestling. Well, and if you've watched any wrestling, and my greatest moment is I saw Hulk Hogan wrestle Andre the Giant live and in person, Rupp Arena, Lexington, Kentucky, 1988. Glorious. But in wrestling, you'll always know somebody's coming out because they got music playing. They have the music. So is that the Undertaker's music? Is that the Rock's music? Well, when there is hatred and there is division and animosity, that's when followers of Jesus Christ should hear their music. Not to contribute to it, but to heal it. It's like, imagine that there's hatred and division and you hear Amazing Grace. I need to move. I need to do something here. Because we are the community, the followers of Jesus Christ are the community that is perfectly instructed and formed to deal with this moment. I want to talk about a few verses from Scripture. First, 2 Timothy 1:7. If we're talking about a world in which people are full of fear and timidity, 2 Timothy 1:7 says something. God did not give us a spirit of timidity. Many translations say fear, but a spirit of power. Now, that's not political power, because this is written to the first century church that had no power at all, but faith in the power of God, love and self-control, restraint. We don't go along with the crowd. We don't go along with the crowd. How do we execute on this? Micah 6:8. You know what the Lord has required of you, O man, what is good, that we do justice, we love kindness, and walk humbly with God. Think about how countercultural that is. How countercultural that is. In a time where people are angry, in a time where people are furious with each other, we have no fear. In a time where people are cruel to each other, we are kind. In a time where people are arrogant, we are humble. And what does that do? It binds us to other human beings. It gives openings to love other people. You know, I wrote something in the Times recently. I said, what is the one thing you can actually do in this country? What's the most concrete thing that you can actually do in this country to heal our divides politically is actually to extend yourself personally to another human being, to become a friend, to love another human being, to love your neighbor, to allow others to feel a sense of belonging in the United States of America. George Washington understood the mission of this country. And there was something that he wrote. There was a verse that he used almost 50 times in his writings. And the verse is Micah 4:4. It's a beautiful verse. But they shall sit every man under his vine and his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken. What does this mean? This is talking about a beautiful vision of belonging, and he most famously used it when talking to the Hebrew congregation of Rhode Island, this incredibly persecuted minority, Jewish Americans, who were a tiny community at the founding of our country, wanted to know from the first president of this constitutional republic, where do they fit? Where do they fit? And he responded to them in a famous letter that you can still see it in Rhode Island, famous letter that tells them, that assures them, that in this land, every man shall sit under his own vine, his own fig tree, and none shall make them afraid. That's his vision of America. And so I began with a story of friendship. I want to end with a story of friendship. I think all of us knows what it's like to be alone. And I will tell you the moment in my life where I probably felt more alone than any moment ever. I was called up and volunteered to join the 2nd Squadron, 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment in Diyala Province in late 2007. And I was a reservist joining an active duty unit. And if anybody in here has military experience, you know that the active duty folks don't really love the reserve folks all that much. They see us as weekend warriors. And then you add the weekend warrior and it's a bald lawyer who shows up, like, doubly not impressive. This might come as some surprise, but I don't actually present like SEAL Team 6 in person up close. I really don't. So here I am coming to this place, and they did not want me. They did not want me. My commander literally did not want me. I heard this shouting match argument between the regimental deputy commander and my squadron commander, because he didn't want the reserve lawyer. And it was ended by the deputy regimental commander yelling at him over the phone in my presence, "Paul, he went to bleepin' Harvard." Like, that didn't help. That does not help. I did not go to the Harvard School of War, by the way. I don't know why that was. So I fly in. I have this perception that nobody wants me. And there's somebody who greets me. And that was an accurate perception, by the way. There was somebody, though, who greeted me. His name's Leo. Leo greets me. And he says, "You're with me, lawyer." That's what they called me before they liked me, just lawyer. "You're with me, lawyer." And he brought me into his, you know, I became his roommate. He embraced me from the word go. Instantly, as soon as I landed off that helipad, he didn't know anything about me except that I was the reservist that nobody wanted. That's what he knew. And he decided, I'm going to be his friend. And we're about as different as two people could be. I'm a white Southern evangelical, at the time partisan Republican. He is a Mexican-American immigrant, former Catholic, former LDS, who claims that he only now worships the Hubble Space Telescope because it sees further than anybody. He was also for Obama before that was cool. I was for Romney. And I don't know if that ever got cool, but we're about as different as you could be. And I never converted him to my faith. He definitely did not convert me to Hubbleism. But we were inseparable. We were inseparable. And when you're downrange in Iraq, you can go nowhere by yourself. You always have to have a battle buddy. Now, that's the Army's term, not mine. I wish it was something more vicious sounding than that. Like, unhand me or my battle buddy here is going to have a word with you. But that's what we were called. So this agnostic, far left friend of mine, one of the things he did for me was he went to chapel with me every week, so that I would never have to, I had to go with somebody. I could not go by myself. And so he spent almost a year going to chapel with me so that I could go to chapel. And we fought the whole time. We debated the whole time, but we loved each other and love each other. And I'll never forget, right when I was redeploying back home, I thought, Leo's been so good to me, welcomed me so much. So I gave him a gift. I have friends from law school, had connections with the Obama campaign. And I got him prime tickets to the inaugural, just perfect tickets. He was so grateful. He was so happy. You want to know how he thanked me for it? So on the inauguration day, when Obama is sworn in, and he knew I had great admiration for George W. Bush, he sends me a video of him outside the White House when Marine One is lifting off with George W. Bush for the last time. He filmed that for me while very helpfully singing, na 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 na, na na na. But I wouldn't want it any other way. I guess I have interesting friends. Like, one's going to bail on me in the middle of a prank. Another one's going to taunt me long distance while my president is being ejected from office. I need to think this through a little bit more. But what I think about, what is it that grounds me in a difficult moment in American history? What is it that teaches me not to hate the other? What grounds me not to hate the other is this understanding and knowledge of who the other is, because they're also my friends. They're people I know and they're people I love. You know, I used to say, I've talked a lot about friendship because we have this friendship desert in this country. And I used to say, everybody needs a Leo. You know, everyone needs somebody like that in their life who's not a factional friend, like they're with me as so long as I agree with them politically, or they're with me so long as I rightfully agree that Rings of Power is better than House of the Dragon or whatever, you know, which is true, by the way. That is not a conditional friendship. It is this concept of unconditional love. And what community of people are better equipped to offer unconditional love to their neighbors than followers of Jesus Christ, who offered unconditional love to us? So what is it that's breaking us? It's hatred. It's animosity. What is it that can unite us? Love. Friendship. Here's our mission. Here's our mission. To be a Leo, to reach out to somebody else with fairness, with kindness, with humility, because not any one of us knows everything. To act justly, to love kindness, and to walk humbly before the Lord your God. To what end? To what end? So that my neighbor, who I love, can feel like they belong in this place. So act justly. Love, kindness, walk humbly. Why? So that every man can live under his own vine, his own fig tree, and no one will make him afraid. Thank you very much.